Welcome to this new detailed edition of the BayPay Forum Blockchain News. My name is Cindy and today is September 17, 2020. This edition is brought to you by PayCademy, the first business academy to learn payments and fintech. If you have some news in payments and fintech, send it to us at press@baypayforum.com and we will do our best to include your news. In this edition, we will talk about Ethereum's pending transactions jump 30% after Uniswap's token claim begins. Wyoming bank regulator taps Chainalysis to boost crypto tracing efforts. How normies are getting crypto rich with DeFi. China's BSN to localize 24 public blockchains by making them permissioned. Say hello to the singularity. The $55 million hack that almost brought Ethereum down. Now let's get started. Ethereum's pending transactions jump 30% after Uniswap's token claim begins. The number of pending transactions on Ethereum per minute jumped 30% after the claim for Uniswap's UNI token began. The decentralized trading platform announced around 0:30 Coordinated Universal Time Thursday it launched its governance token, dubbed UNI, with 1 billion coins that will be released over the next 4 years. While the liquidity mining for the governance token will not start until Friday, Uniswap said historical users and liquidity providers on the platform are now able to claim for 400 UNI per each address. 15% of UNI, 150 million UNI, can immediately be claimed by historical liquidity providers, users, and SOX redeemers holders based on a snapshot ending September 1, 2020, at 12 a.m. Coordinated Universal Time, Uniswap said in a blog post. Following the announcement, the number of pending transactions on the Ethereum network per minute has jumped from around 160,000 to over 210,000 as of writing, according to data on blockchain explorer Etherscan. Within 3 hours after the claim started, over 18,000 transactions were sent to the smart contract address of the UNI governance token, with more than 5,000 of them pending at the time. The total number of transactions has now reached over 26,000 while the pending ones have dropped to around 3,700 as of writing. The increasing number of transactions sent to the UNI smart contract appears to have led to a surge of the gas fee on the Ethereum network, which Uniswap's protocol is built on. The current average gas fee on Ethereum has reached 650 Gwei, compared to the average 152 Gwei on Wednesday UTC time, based on Etherscan's data. In fact, the UNI token's smart contract address is now ranking third in terms of the overall transaction fees in the past 3 hours, with a total of 534 ETH worth over $200,000 as of writing, according to Etherscan. Even the site traffic on the Blockchain Explorer has reached a peak. The last time Etherscan site traffic peaked to the current level was during the 2017-2018 ICO mania. Kudos to Uniswap for the successful launch of the UNI token, said Etherscan's founder and CEO Matthew Tan in a tweet. Within hours of Uniswap's announcement, major centralized exchanges including Binance, Huobi and OKEx listed trading pairs for the governance token, which is now changing hands at around $2.90. Wyoming bank regulator taps Chainalysis to boost crypto tracing efforts. Wyoming's chief banking regulator has turned to Chainalysis for beefing up his division's monitoring capabilities of illicit cryptocurrency activities. Under a one-year deal disclosed to CoinDesk Thursday, Chainalysis will train senior examiners on crypto tracing practices and grant 2 monitoring software licenses plus investigatory support to the Division of Banking as it eases into its new, crypto-facing compliance duties, according to Commissioner Albert Faulkner. Unveiled just one day after Wyoming awarded its first special purpose depository institution SPDI, bank charter to Kraken, the novel partnership, among the earliest pair-ups featuring a U.S. banking regulator and a blockchain intelligence firm, illustrates how even America's fast-moving financial watchdogs are cautiously approaching oversight of an asset class that Faulkner said still gives some folks the spooks. Just the nature of digital assets and the pseudonymity of them have a lot of people concerned about illicit activity, Faulkner said. When you introduce a new dynamic like this, he said, regulators have to ensure the newcomers are playing by the rules. Those rules are no different than the ones governing traditional American banks. Watch out for signs of money laundering, don't transact with sanctioned individuals, keep tabs on customer identities and uphold the minutiae of the Bank Secrecy Act. As is for cash, so too for crypto. But blockchains give Wyoming's banking regulators a powerful upside that cash cannot match, an immutable, public paper trail built into its code. And while anyone with an internet connection can manually hop between Bitcoin addresses, it's only with visualization and tracing tools, like those sold by Chainalysis, that regulators have long sought to unscramble illicit chains. Chainalysis is among a handful of tracers supporting governments, companies and regulators with cryptocurrency monitoring software. It has particularly deep ties to federal law enforcement. The New York-based firm has banked millions in contracts with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Drug Enforcement Agency, Internal Revenue Service and other federal agencies in need of crypto support. Chainalysis and Faulkner declined to state this deal's dollar value. If, say, a bank allows its customers to send crypto to a blacklisted wallet address, then we've got proof of those activities that Faulkner said has held up in court. It will also make working with law enforcement easier, Faulkner said. He hopes it won't come to that. Once Kraken's banking business gets rolling in early 2021 and perhaps other SPDIs and even non-crypto-specific banks start dealing in crypto, too, he said the division of banking will start back-tracing transaction blocks to ensure the institutions are self-monitoring effectively. We'll be running our own analysis on that, and verifying that the red flags that we see are the same ones that the SPDIs see, Faulkner said. Jesse Spiro, Chainalysis Global Head of Policy, told CoinDesk the move is a first step in providing oversight of the crypto space within Wyoming. I've told our applicants and potential applicants, my job is not to run your business and I don't want to have government overreach. But there is an appropriate level of oversight and monitoring, and this is just one more of those, Faulkner said. How normies are getting crypto rich with DeFi. Ethereum whales undoubtedly drive the decentralized finance DeFi movement, but many people making money on DeFi trends are just regular Joes, so to speak. One such trader, who asked to go only by Joe, is a math student at a Canadian university. Just by playing with Ethereum software and his own calculations, he managed to make hundreds of thousands of dollars in 2020. This wasn't his first rodeo, however, he's been trading on decentralized exchanges, DEXs, for more than a year. I am not a whale in the crypto world, but I am one of the top users of the DeFi protocol I use, he said. Before, when DeFi was smaller, there was a lot less competition. Since Weird DeFi's food craze began, Joe said high yields are now available to newcomers without a lot of technical knowledge. It's impossible to say just how many rookie traders raked in unusually high profits during the YAM debacle in August, when an unaudited crypto experiment garnered $465 million in crypto then imploded within 72 hours. One such anonymous YAM user, who said he rarely trades on exchanges, said he found the YAM trading game fun and relatively easy. He participated in the community vote to save YAM, then said he promptly dumped his tokens when he realized the software experiment was not sustainable. All things considered, he said he earned $15,000 from participating in YAM, having spent up to $800 on transaction fees. For both of the above-mentioned DeFi fans, this is a life-changing amount of money. These users often rely on service providers to access the DeFi ecosystem. As such, traders weren't the only winners of the YAM gambling game. Companies that run the Ethereum network also accrued traffic and transaction fees during the rise of YAM and Sushi, Cream and now Pickle. I access farming and do most one-time things with MetaMask, Joe said. The only other service I use is the Web3 provider Infura. DeFi infrastructure. The DeFi mentality emphasizes open source access to tools, services with low barriers to entry and distributed teams. Sometimes, this includes low barriers to entry for high-risk games. According to Uniswap founder Hayden Adams in June 2020, most of the Uniswap ecosystem relies on consensus infrastructure services, like Infura. This has also proven to be the common pattern for copycat DeFi projects like SushiSwap. Consensus spokesperson James Beck said the Ethereum conglomerate restructured to make infrastructure and wallet services, like Infura and the DeFi-friendly wallet MetaMask, pillars of the company's core software business. Consensus head of product for Infura, Michael Godsey, said his team handled the increased usage from the food-themed yield farming spike, watching closely to understand these new usage patterns. Such DeFi experiments provide inspiration and research data for Ethereum startups, not chagrin. In reference to the DEX tools people use to access these trading games, Godsey added, Uniswap and MetaMask are two of our amazing customers and many yield farmers are utilizing their platform to participate in this new activity. As for Joe, the Canadian college student, he said he plans to keep stacking tokens because the broader DeFi movement is sustainable and has been growing at a relatively slow pace for years. On the other hand, he said the trends over the past few months were heavily influenced by Compound's token model. Joe reasoned these DeFi experiments might end in a big crash or slow fizzle. As long as risk-adjusted yield is higher than for other opportunities, I will keep using them, he said. China's BSN to localize 24 public blockchains by making them permissioned. China's state-sanctioned blockchain infrastructure project is finally bringing public chains to its Chinese users, but with a significant twist. The blockchain-based service network, BSN, a standardized internet services provider for decentralized applications, DApp, developers, plans to make 24 public chains available in its network for Chinese users starting from the second half of November, according to an internal memo obtained by CoinDesk. Developers can use the technical frameworks behind these public chains to build and run dApps that serve a range of purposes such as financing platforms for small and medium enterprises, source tracking for food companies and record keeping for banks, law firms or government agencies. These public chains will look quite different after being localized for the Chinese market, however. The network will make the decentralized public chains permissioned and replace their tokens with direct payment by the Chinese currency renminbi to cover transaction fees on these chains. This is part of a much larger story. The Chinese government is an active supporter of blockchain technology, but only on its own terms. Authorities would like to reap the benefits of blockchain tech's traceability and efficiency, but without the decentralization embraced by public chains like Bitcoin and Ethereum. BSN's latest move came 1 month after the network integrated 6 major public chains into the global version of its network. This was so that developers outside China could use a standardized development environment to build and run decentralized applications on these public chains. Unlike in the localized version, public decentralized chains are allowed in the global version of BSN. There have been few effective ways for public chains to enter the Chinese market and scale up due to legal and regulatory requirements and how these projects position themselves, the memo, translated by CoinDesk from the original Chinese, said of this latest development. The public decentralized chains will become public permissioned consortium chains, which can be supervised by regulators, and that is currently the most direct and effective way for the projects to be compliant and reach domestic users within China. These new permission chains will look very different from the original versions. To make public decentralized chains, such as Ethereum, permissioned, BSN will only allow its designated operators to build and operate nodes, where dApps verify on-chain transactions and store data. The network will block all peer-to-peer fee transactions and require its users to use renminbi instead of Ethereum gas to cover fees for building and running dApps on-chain. BSN has made it technically impossible to do any virtual currency transactions on the public chains, the memo said. BSN strictly follows related laws and regulations and will remove any chain that violates them from the network. BSN aims to complete all 24 public chains integration with the domestic version of the network during the first quarter of 2021 and enable these chains to share data with each other in the first half of the same year. The network has formed Public Permission Blockchain, a consortium to govern the services on adapted public chains. Huobi Group, as the only named member of the consortium in the memo, will be in charge of transaction settlement and clearing, marketing for the new services and operating the official portal. An unnamed cloud services provider will offer the adapted public chains data storage and other basic internet resources. One of BSN's backers is Chinese tech conglomerate China Mobile, which has an extensive network of data centers across the country. BSN has also worked with the Chinese branch of Amazon Web Service to provide internet services for dApps. BSN is backed by the State Information Center of China, a think tank under the National Development and Reform Commission, NDRC, the highest economic planning agency. BSN will be responsible for compliance with Chinese regulators and adapting the public chain's technical framework into the network. While the memo does not disclose any names of these 24 public chains, BSN has already integrated major international projects including Tezos, Ethereum and Cosmos IrisNet. The 24 public chains are highly reputable in the global blockchain community. However, we will not use their original names when they go live on BSN, the memo said. The chains will be renamed based on 24 Chinese solar terms, a traditional agricultural calendar that informs farmers of seasonal changes. For example, one of the 24 solar terms is first frost, which indicates the weather is getting colder and water droplets are starting to freeze. Insect awakening means it is getting warmer and insects that hibernate underground are about to wake up and go outside. The forbidden fruit. Public decentralized blockchains have been under heavy scrutiny from the Chinese government since 2017, when China cracked down on initial coin offerings and local exchanges. ICO projects were hard to supervise because of their decentralized nature, and authorities feared that wild token speculation could undermine China's financial stability. The tokens from public chain projects are a threat to China's long-standing capital control and monetary sovereignty of the Chinese currency. For example, Tether, an Ethereum-based token pegged to the US dollar, has become one of the most popular ways for cross-border transactions between Asia and the rest of the world. Authorities may also fear tokens could threaten the use of the renminbi and that would jeopardize monetary policies relying on the control of supply and demand of the Chinese currency. In part to preempt the rise of tokens such as Bitcoin, the Chinese central bank invented its own national virtual currency, Digital Currency Electronic Payment, DCEP, or the Digital Yuan. Another reason why China is critical of public decentralized chain projects is the potential for scams, such as Ponzi and pump and dump schemes offered as initial coin offerings, ICO, that mushroomed during and after the 2017 ICO boom. In September 2017, the Chinese central bank made any centralized ICO fundraising illegal. The People's Bank of China also carried out a slew of crackdowns on centralized crypto exchanges and fiat crypto trading, and prohibited any Chinese bank from processing crypto-related transactions. Inspired by Ant Chain, Ant Chain, a permissioned enterprise blockchain developed by Ant Financial, a subsidiary of Chinese tech giant Alibaba, has been one of the inspirations for BSN to launch the Public Permission Blockchain Consortium, according to the memo. It was a milestone when the company launched Ant Blockchain Open Alliance, a consortium that governs its blockchain-based platform, lowering the cost for small and medium enterprises to use blockchain technology, the memo said. Technically speaking, it is a public permission chain with a few authorized nodes. One of the main missions for Ant Financial is to provide small and medium enterprises with a more accessible financing platform based on its public permissioned blockchain technology. The company could also leverage the large client base of Alibaba's other subsidiaries, such as AliCloud for internet and data services and the digital payment company Ant Financial for any financial transactions in its app. Ant Financial claims its users had been uploading an average of $100 million in digital assets, including copyright and property ownership certificates as well as transaction records, to its blockchain in July. Chinese shipping giant Costco said it was trialing Ant Chain for tamper-free documentation including container records and import licenses. The company aims to go public on the Shanghai and Hong Kong stock exchanges at a valuation of $200 billion. If the deal follows through, it will be arguably the largest company that operates its own enterprise blockchain. Say hello to the singularity. The current blockchain world is so full of crazy ups and downs, it's easy to become so focused on the short term that one loses track of the big picture. But it's important to fight this tendency because the big picture is awfully big. Revolutionizing finance, the aspect of blockchain's future that gets the most attention, is only a part of the story. Blockchain will be a central part of the future of technology and humanity in a very broad sense. As we move toward what Ray Kurzweil has called the technological singularity, in which AIs exceed humans in general intelligence and radically alter every aspect of life on Earth, it is increasingly clear that blockchain will be a critical part of the story. And just as the singularity may unfold with various levels of benefit or destruction, so the role of blockchain may come out positive or negative for humanity. Ben Gortzel is founder and CEO of SingularityNet, a blockchain-based AI marketplace project. This article is a part of the Internet 2030 series, a look at the future of the Internet and our digital lives. It is clear to any rational observer that our current social order, with its rapid growth, exaltation of self-disruption and rampant environmental unsustainability, is transitional and highly temporary in nature. But it's hard to say what will come next. At least three options seem reasonably plausible to me: corporate techno-fascism, decentralized digital democracy, DDD, and human-free. Will we see a dark future of corporate totalitarian hegemony, a democratic, decentralized future of diverse flourishing creativity, or a future in which advanced artificial general intelligence, AGI, tech leaves biological humanity entirely by the wayside? In any of these scenarios, blockchain technology or its direct descendants will play a critical and distinctive role. But the role will be rather different in each case. Further, the ways in which blockchain technology is developed right now will be part of the nexus of factors influencing what sort of outcome eventuates for humanity generally. Bear market for humans. What we are seeing in the global economy right now might be characterized as a bear market for humans. AI and automation are booming, and AI-fueled big tech companies are seeing their market caps soar. Businesses highly dependent on human labor are generally suffering, and often are reorganizing to reduce this reliance. Despite buoyant stock markets and financial innovations like DeFi, wealth and income inequality are increasing. Displaced workers newly joining the unemployment rolls seem likely to stay there long term. This is a bear market for the less educated socioeconomic strata of humans. It will only get worse. As AI advances, the threshold level of education required to compete with mechanical tools and systems will keep rising. One potential endgame of the current direction of technological and economic development will be a world divided into a lot of AIs, a small number of humans owning the companies that own these AIs, a small number of highly educated and specially trained humans doing the few things AIs aren't great at yet, and a whole lot of people with no particular role to play in the economy. It's true that new technologies both obsolete old jobs and created new ones. But the overall pattern is clear. On the whole, the new jobs created will be more exacting in educational requirements and fewer in number. Self-driving trucks will replace human truck drivers, while creating more opportunities for developers of automated navigation algorithms and designers of robots that repair robo-trucks. Corporate techno-fascism or human-free robotopia? It's not inconceivable that, in a future where most people are economically useless to the few who own the means of automated production, these unproductive masses are left to die off. Perhaps there will be a reversion to some form of old-style subsistence farming in the sprawling rubble outside the gated robo-factories. What we are seeing in the global economy right now might be characterized as a bear market for humans. It's also possible that compassion will prevail and the masses will be allowed to survive in a carefully controlled way. In this sort of scenario, blockchain will be highly valuable to the hegemons. Think of the Chinese government's blockchain surveillance strategy rather than the anarcho-libertarian visions of the early Bitcoin and Ethereum communities. Blockchain provides an extraordinarily good tool for maintaining centralized control in a large, complex network, like a global, corporate, techno-fascist social order. It provides unparalleled capability for top-level leaders to make sure that none of their underlings on any level are corrupt, and keeps detailed, real-time records on every member of the society they rule over. As the percentage of economically irrelevant humans increases, blockchain provides a perfect tool for governments and corporations to keep chaos from breaking out via carefully tracking flows of money and information, and making sure that media misinformation is intelligently enough placed to keep the population's mind filled with compliance-inducing narratives. But it's also quite thinkable the size of the elite group of humans controlling the automated means of production fairly rapidly shrinks to zero. Corporate and military leaders will always prefer AI systems that combine creative and ambitious general intelligence with obedience and lack of initiative, but this combination may prove as elusive in AGIs as in humans. There is a scenario where blockchain technology plays an extremely critical role in the future economy by serving as part of the underpinning of the AGI minds that are humanity's successors. No doubt future AGIs will come up with algorithms and structures far more sophisticated than anything we can imagine today, but there will likely be a strong ongoing role for the core principles of mathematically guaranteed security coupled with decentralized consensus in distributed systems. The role of blockchain may indeed be much stronger if the future turns out human-free. The minds replacing humans will probably be secure digital decentralized systems with blockchains integrated into their core code. Decentralized digital democracy. While dark potentials inarguably lurk on the horizon, more beneficial outcomes also remain firmly within reach. It may well happen that the breakthroughs to human-level and superhuman AGI occur in the domain of open-source hackers and decentralized networks rather than corporate or government labs. This is what SingularityNet, Ocean Protocol, and the dozens of other projects in the Decentralized AI Alliance are working toward. There are major challenges, both on the technology side and regarding regulatory issues and market dynamics, but nothing that can't be surmounted with a lot of will, brilliance, and a bit of luck. It is eminently possible to foresee a world in which AGI emerges from decentralized networks controlled by diverse parties, in which various forms of human and cyborg AI interconnect flexibly with various forms of digital and quantum AGI. Perhaps the overall network is controlled and regulated in a hierarchical and open-ended manner rather than controlled by a small number of elite humans or elite computational processes. In such a world, multiple sorts of value will be respected, quantified with a variety of smart contracts going far beyond the money-like tokens dominating the blockchain world today. The rich aesthetic, social, spiritual, and imaginative value of humans, other animals, plants, and new forms of self-organizing living systems will be supported and woven together with advanced digital and quantum technologies, without pressure to reduce the value of an entity to the degree of its participation in efficient processes of material production. Looking closely at the relation between the future of blockchain and the future of humanity, one becomes convinced that the former is much more firmly assured. Yet I remain highly optimistic. There seems a very palpable possibility that we can navigate through the challenges ahead and craft a democratic decentralized future, leveraging the best of humanity and the best of our advanced technologies including blockchain and AI. Every one of us, as we live and act in the world, is helping to birth the future to bias and guide the self-organizing processes via which today's world morphs into the radically different society we'll see tomorrow. Those of us who are writing the code underlying today's blockchain and AI systems, or supporting the projects writing the code, are not the only ones writing the future, but we are definitely a substantial part of the mix. The $55 million hack that almost brought Ethereum down. Bloomberg News reporter Matthew Leising's new book, Out of the Ether, The Amazing Story of Ethereum and the $55 million Heist That Almost Destroyed It All, tells the story of the infamous DAO hack that almost brought down the world's second-largest blockchain. In June 2016, a heretofore unknown assailant or assailants began siphoning off funds from Ethereum's first decentralized autonomous organization, or DAO, a bit of software that functions like a corporation. Weeks earlier, the DAO went live, following a $150 million crowd sale. Tiki DAO had a huge part to play in the early history of Ethereum, leasing rights. It's not overstating it to say that the DAO made Ethereum. That's because it was one of the earliest examples that Ethereum's network of computers was resilient enough to support complex applications. While the attack never broke Ethereum's code, it merely exploited a loophole in the DAO's smart contract. It cast doubt over the viability of a blockchain-based world computer. It was also the beginning of Ethereum's two Ethereums. Leasing, who has been covering the crypto industry for the better half of a decade, had called out sick from work the day a hacker absconded with $55 million in stolen ETH. But he didn't let the story die. Over the past 4 years, he has been reporting out the story told in the book, examining blockchain data, following through on cryptic tips, and ultimately tracing a path towards his leading suspect. In the excerpt below, readers find themselves in Eastern Germany along with Christoph Jentz, one of the DAO's principal architects, who woke up to realize the project he has spent months building is being robbed at the rate of about $8 million an hour. A religious family man, Jentz takes this extemporaneous moment to reflect on the challenges that face the DAO's creation, from security's worries that still plague token projects to the critical opinions of the early Ethereum community before taking action. Dan Kuhn. Chapter 7. The town of Mittweida in the state of Saxony in Germany escaped being bombed in the Second World War. In the middle of town, old stone streets divide rows of brightly colored buildings. If you leave the town square and walk for about 10 minutes, you'll come to a quiet street with a police station. Next door is a mint greenhouse with brown trim and shutters. On Friday, June 17, 2016, just after 8 a.m., Christoph Jentz lay on the beige carpet of the first floor office inside. He tried to still his breathing, to take deep breaths, to not let the world get away from him. Thieves were inside the DAO, his creation, robbing it at the rate of about $8 million an hour. One of the first things Christoph felt was relief. Finally, the DAO saga would come to an end. It had overtaken his life for the past 6 months. Head battled anxiety and depression and exhaustion. Head neglected his wife and 5 kids. There had been moments when he froze at the thought of releasing the DAO code, because once it was out in the world, it couldn't be changed. There could be a bug in the software, or maybe terrorists could figure out how to use it to fund an attack he'd be powerless to stop. The pressure made him physically ill several times. Head puked under the strain. God, please, let this be the end of all that. But Christoph also felt a strong sense of responsibility. It shook him that Head messed up so badly and that people were losing money because of it. He believed in the ideas underpinning DAOs. The language gets a bit confusing here, as there were other DAOs around at this point, Maker DAO among them. DAO is a generic term for the structure that smart contracts fit into, but because of its eventual size and high profile, Jentz's DAO became the DAO. There were so many fears, Griff said. Does this destroy Ethereum? Does this destroy DAOs? What's going to happen to all this money? A DAO is what got him into Ethereum in the first place, the moment he realized its potential. Vitalik's white paper had outlined a vision for how DAOs could democratize corporate structures to replace owners, employees, and investors with users who directly manage the firm's affairs with smart contracts encoded on the blockchain. That breakthrough is what made Christoph pause his PhD studies and start working for Ethereum in 2015. And then, improbably, he built one. The biggest DAO ever built, in fact, which made it a fat target. After all the security checks, Christoph couldn't understand why no one had found the right bug in time. He got up from the floor of the office and went back to his IBM ThinkPad laptop. Christoph knew the cops next door couldn't help him. No, this was his mess and he'd have to clean it up. In one sense, if toasters and door locks were allowed to have bank accounts, the DAO never would have happened. At least, that financial discrimination against appliances and hardware had stirred Christoph's imagination when he first encountered Ethereum. Now that the cryptocurrency Ether had been created, the question that plagued Christoph's mind was, how could it best be used? Not as a straight cryptocurrency like Bitcoin. Rather, Ether seemed perfectly suited to be a form of micropayment for what Christoph likes to call the economy of things. Airbnb had become popular around this time, and when Christoph looked at the company through his Ethereum lens, he saw nothing but a middleman to be eliminated. What if, with a smart lock on your front door connected to the Ethereum blockchain, you could rent out your apartment directly to someone else? There would still be a website like Airbnb's to let an apartment owner find a renter, but the Ethereum version would differ in one key way. The website would connect people peer-to-peer and there would be no Airbnb in the middle taking its 30% cut of the profits. Where does Airbnb's business model account for that kind of disruption? This is exactly the kind of simple but very powerful idea that overtakes Ethereum followers. It made me realize its potential on the day in Brooklyn, NY, that Joe Lubin explained it to me. Put a similar type of lock on your car. How does Hertz feel about that? Look at Uber in this way too. It could be as easy to move in on their ride-sharing market as it was for them to take on the taxi industry. The promise for Ethereum, in my view, is in large part intertwined with this sort of reimagination of the World Wide Web. If Vitalik and friends can offer an alternative internet that is peer-to-peer where middlemen are shunned, things cost less, and privacy and data security are taken seriously, that's a killer combo. I would sign up for that. Yet it's far from assured that they will pull it off. For years now, this doubt about whether Ethereum can really deliver on its promise has been in the background of all my work on it. That's not to say anything about the thousands of people working on Ethereum as developers, entrepreneurs, and salespeople. They are all doing amazing things. But maybe it'll turn out to be a neat diversion that captured people's imagination for many years but ultimately came to nothing. It will have to fight for any gains it makes, that's for sure. Airbnb, Hertz, and Uber aren't going to let Ethereum just roll into town and eliminate their businesses. These are global corporations with billions of dollars backing them. Then there's the state of the actual technology. Ethereum is a long way from having the scale and robustness needed to support millions of users. Regulatory issues are another hurdle. But although the odds are long, there are plenty of people like Christoph, a theoretical physicist, who are willing to drop everything to work on Ethereum and willing to bet on the payout. While researching his dissertation, Christoph needed to amass a cluster of computer hard drives to simulate his work on generating very long molecules. What worked better than CPUs, he learned, were graphics processing units, or GPUs, which would be faster and more efficient at crunching the data. He looked into buying a bunch of GPUs and ran straight into Bitcoin, as GPUs were the preferred hardware for Bitcoin miners. Soon he was down the rabbit hole, and then in January 2014 he came across Vitalik's white paper. "I was totally blown away," Christoph said. Now it made sense. Bitcoin was just a cryptocurrency, but this was a decentralized application platform. The possibilities of what you could do on Ethereum seemed endless to him. Christoph has so many kids that he can forget how many he had at a particular point in his life. But in the summer of 2014 he needed to earn some extra money, and it doesn't matter if he had 3 or 4 children at the time. He'd seen a presentation where Ethereum co-founder Gavin Wood talked about the money Ethereum was raising in a crowd sale and that it hoped to open a Berlin office and hire C++ developers. That's exactly what Christoph knew how to do, and Gavin soon hired him. He became the lead tester for the blockchain protocol. Ethereum was written using 3 programming languages, C++, Python, and Go. These are the clients that made the blockchain work. But if they don't talk to each other so that an action on C++ is interpreted in exactly the same way on the Go client, the whole thing breaks down. The blockchain must be sequential above all, so if there's a breakdown it causes what's called a fork. When there's a fork, 2 strings of blocks are created and it can be hard to know which string is the official transaction record. Christoph made it his job to attack the 3 clients to try to make them fail, to fork. He worked most closely with Vitalik, Gavin, and Jeff Wilk. They were all trying to pass my tests, Christoph said. After about 10 months working on Ethereum, Christoph wanted to take it to the next level. Had been pondering the best use for Ether and decided it would be for micropayments to internet-connected devices. He formed Slock.it with his brother Simon and Stefan Tuol, who each controlled a third of the company. At a BitDevs meetup in New York City on June 13, 2015, at the offices of venture capital firm Union Square Ventures, Christoph publicly unveiled the idea for Slock.it for the first time. Joe Lubin was there that day. Christoph used his phone to connect to Ethereum and unlock a door handle had brought with him. This was so early in the company's history that they called themselves EtherLock. Christoph received warm welcomes as he went around introducing people to smart locks. The idea gained a following, and now he had to figure out how to fund its development. He soon realized that his desire to build a DAO could be fulfilled, and he began to figure out how it would work. But he not only had to figure out the mechanics of the smart contract. There were thornier issues, like would the Slock.it team be legally responsible for what the DAO enabled? They had lawyers working on this question in New York, Switzerland, and Germany. They actually said, well, if you are not very attached to the project, you just write the contract and publish it, and you will later on ask to work for this company, it will be legally fine, Christoph said. This was a mark of how decentralized the goal was here. Even the people who would bring the DAO to life imagine that they'd have to ask to work for their own creation. How the heck do you do that? Easy, it's like any other proposal to the DAO, it gets voted on by DAO token holders. Christoph and the rest of the Slock.it team felt comfortable with the idea that DAO token holders would vote to fund their startup, out of courtesy to the creators of the DAO, if nothing else. Then they had to contend with what a regulator like the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission would think of the DAO. Would a DAO token be deemed a security? If so, they'd need to go through a strict registration process and provide potential investors with all sorts of information about the business plan, risks, and other details meant to enhance transparency for investors. Their lawyers had an answer for this, too. Even if it is a security, the formation of a company is not something you need to ask the SEC for approval, Christoph said. We saw the DAO creation as the formation of a company, but not with three founders, with 23,000 founders. Let's fast forward here for a moment and ask an interesting question. According to Slock.it's lawyers, the token sale wouldn't be considered a security offering in part because the DAO had thousands of founders. What does that say about what Ethereum did with its Ether crowd sale? Remember, these are distinct events. The Ethereum co-founders, including Gavin Wood, Vitalik, and Mihai Alizi, sold Ether to the public in mid-2014 to raise money to fund development of the Ethereum blockchain. A discreet, small group of people earned a lot of money through the Ethereum token sale. Doesn't that imply that Ether is a security? The Ether sale raised $18 million. Co-founders such as Joe Lubin and Anthony DiIorio were adamant that Ether was not a security, but really all they had to back that up was their own opinions and the legal opinion from a lawyer in a situation that hadn't been vetted by a government agency like the SEC. Then the DAO comes along and Slock.it's lawyers say that if its executives are not attached to the project and everyone who buys DAO tokens is considered a founder, boom. You're not a security. See the inconsistency? Under this logic, either a DAO token or Ether is a security, but both of them can't escape the designation. On the US front, at least, the reality is that in 20,142,015 the SEC was asleep at the switch. No one in the government was paying attention to what was going on with the nascent ICO market. The SEC wouldn't start bringing enforcement cases until years later, and it didn't get around to writing its opinion on the DAO until a year after it blew up. We'll get to this a bit later in the story. Now, back to the DAO. The people who bought DAO tokens never gave their money to Christoph or anyone at Slock.it. They were in control of it the whole time and only interacted with a smart contract that exchanged their Ether for DAO tokens. They could get their Ether back if they wanted to. It's not overstating it to say that the DAO made Ethereum. The brightest minds in Ethereum at the time also gathered to act as a sort of fail-safe mechanism to prevent an attack against the DAO. Known as curators, group members included Vitalik, Vlad Zamfir, Alex van de Sande, Gavin Wood, Taylor Gehring, Aaron Buchanan, and others. The group was meant to signal that the smartest people in the room had looked at the DAO and implied a type of seal of approval. The curators were exposed as nothing more than window dressing, however, after a number of security flaws were found in the DOA code. After presenting the idea of the DAO at DEF CON 1 in London in November of 2015, excitement only grew around the project. The DAO public Slack channel soon boasted 5,000 members. Christoph thought if each of them bought $1,000 worth of DAO tokens, they'd be dealing with $5 million. That seemed manageable. But as the months came and went, a new concern began to gnaw at Christoph. Now that he was into the guts of writing the DAO code, he couldn't escape its fundamental nature. Once released into the world, it was unstoppable. That was a hell of a lot of pressure to handle when the code you are writing in has only been in existence for a few months and bugs are being found in it on a seemingly constant basis. In March of 2016, Slack.it paid $10,000 for a security audit of the DAO code to the Seattle firm Deja Vu Security. The company specializes in examining and testing software meant to power the IoT. Christoph went to Seattle for a week to work with the Deja Vu Security team. I was staying in an Airbnb and feeling almost sick, like, do I really want to do this? I was really nervous. What did I get into here? Christoph said. There was still time to say no, he thought. But Christoph couldn't quit, not on his partners, not on his brother Simon, the CEO of Slack.it. They'd maxed out their credit cards, the bank account was empty. They paid Deja Vu Security out of their pockets, and Christoph knew he couldn't keep asking for one more month for testing. Then there was the wider community, who were watching every development. It's important to note here that the DAO had a huge part to play in the early history of Ethereum. It's not overstating it to say that the DAO made Ethereum. There were smaller projects here and there, but nothing with the scope and ambition of what the DAO wanted to do. You can see its influence on the price of Ether. As 2016 began, the only things the Ethereum community had to look forward to in terms of progress were new versions of the base layer software being released. Put another way, there wasn't much of a catalyst for the digital currency Ether to go up in value. And while work on the underlying Ethereum network was important, no one would use a network that doesn't have applications on top of it. This is why the DAO was vital. As the months went by in 2016, Ether's price began to rise. Aside from the network upgrades I mentioned, I can't find any other reason than the imminent deployment of the DAO for the gain in Ether value. By mid-March, it traded at $15. The demand to become part of the DAO was the fuel. You first had to buy Ether to then buy DAO tokens, so it's easy to see that thousands of people were converting Bitcoin to Ether to then buy DAO tokens, sending the price of Ether to a record high. Everyone was in on it. There wasn't anything else to do with Ether at the time, to be honest. That's a big reason the DAO grew to $150 million in pure Ether purchases. Soon Christoph didn't feel like himself anymore. The stress was winning. This wasn't like him. He came from a large, stable family. The Gents clan had lived in the Mittweida area since the 1500s. His parents have 36 grandchildren. Christoph also had a strong connection to his Mormon faith. His grandfather had brought the religion to Mittweida when Head started the First Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in the small town. Christoph's wife was another calming influence on him and had supported him through the DAO roller coaster. And still he felt he was getting sucked into the chaos. He went up and down in depressive fits. Like the DAO code, it seemed unstoppable once deployed. Griff Green was in Mittweida on the day of the attack. He woke in the spare bedroom of Christoph's mom's house to his smartphone blowing up with messages that the DAO was being hacked. He called Simon and Simon called Christoph. Griff hadn't seen Christoph in such bad shape before. Before becoming Slack.it's first employee, Griff had done Thai massage in Beverly Hills. I didn't have a license to do it, because you know I am not the kind of guy to get a license, he said. There was this very intense moment that day when Christoph was like, I don't know what to do. He wasn't crying, but he looked like he was on the verge and he just had to lay down. He was having kind of a panic attack. Griff went to work on his boss and friend, giving him a massage to help calm him down. Germans aren't the most touchy-feely guys, Green said. There were so many fears, Griff said. Does this destroy Ethereum? Does this destroy DAOs? What's going to happen to all this money? Not a cent in the DAO belonged to Gents. This was other people's money, and for a religious, family-oriented man, a good man, that made the theft all the more troubling. Dealing with other people's money fucking sucks, you know, Griff said. As the May 28th DAO fundraising deadline had approached, the amount of Ether in the DAO just kept going up. No one could ignore the magnitude of what the DAO was becoming right in front of their eyes. The $5 million Christoph expected became a drop in the bucket and he began to freak out. I was really not a good husband or father at this time, Christoph said. He lay in bed that Friday morning when the phone rang. His wife answered and then told Christoph that his brother had said something was wrong with the DAO and he needed to log on right away. In his home office, Christoph checked Etherscan, the Ethereum blockchain block explorer, kind of like Google for a blockchain. He saw money leaving the DAO through the split function, which existed in case a DAO user wanted to get their money back and leave. In the beginning I thought, well, it's just someone leaving the DAO, he said. But then it's very weird, it's always the same amount coming out all the time. And it was one transaction, so one transaction and many payouts. But it should be only one payout per transaction. Something was very wrong. He lay on the floor of his office then, trying to keep the world from slipping away. Yet he felt a mix of emotions. There were two kinds of feelings in me, Christoph said. One feeling was I felt released because this was clearly the end of the DAO. This insane, amazing, stressful chapter in his life would finally be over. His responsibility would cease. On the other side, there was shock and a feeling of, I basically messed up the whole system. I need to fix this now, he said. I need to find out what's going on, people are losing money. I could go to jail. This kind of fear. He got up off the floor and started to fight back. This concludes our edition for today. We want to thank again Paycademy, the first business school to learn payments and fintech, for their support. You can find more information on their website at paycademy.com. We hope you enjoyed it and see you tomorrow for our next edition.